Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, the Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. If you're watching this on YouTube, be sure to subscribe to our channel, at Lungcast, to get updates and new episodes and interview segments. If you're listening to this on your podcast player, you can do the same there as well. You can also get more Lungcast episodes and segments on hcplive.com and lung.org. Our September 2023 topic and interview is as timely as it gets in pulmonary news of late, a discussion on RSV or respiratory syncytial virus. RSV is the leading cause of lower respiratory tract infections in young children and infants. 4 to 5 million children younger than 4 years of age acquire the RSV infection, and more than 125,000 are hospitalized annually in the United States because of this infection. Unfortunately, the impact of RSV infection is not limited to only young children. It is responsible for 177,000 hospitalizations and 14,000 deaths in those over 65 years of age in this country alone. Globally, it costs an estimated $5 billion and more significantly causes more than 100,000 deaths and over 3.5 million hospitalizations per year, mostly in infants and low middle-income countries. For this reason, I've invited our expert today, Dr. Barbara Taylor, who is Professor of Infectious Diseases and the Assistant Dean for the MD-MPH program at University of Texas Health System in San Antonio, to tell us about RSV and the important events of 2023 that have changed the landscape for preventing this all-too-troublesome and deadly infection. Welcome, Dr. Taylor, and thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we're coming into the fall with back-to-school and flu season ahead of us and the rising incidence of COVID infections, please tell us about RSV infection, how it's transmitted, and how it may present, and most importantly, how clinicians will have to make the diagnosis.
Thanks so much, Dr. Rizzo. I completely agree. This is a very timely Lungcast because RSV is already on the rise this fall. So like many respiratory viruses, it is transmitted on droplets that travel through the air. It can also be transmitted through direct contact and through fomites or virus particles that can be on objects like pacifiers or countertops. It is highly transmissible, but fortunately, for the vast majority of people, it causes a mild cold or an upper respiratory infection. However, it's also really common in young children, and as you mentioned, it is the most common cause for hospitalization of young children. Almost all kids have had RSV by the time they are 3 years old, and it also occurs regularly in adults. In certain populations, particularly infants under 12 months and older adults and people who are immunocompromised, it can cause a more severe lower respiratory tract infection. In these cases, it can present as a viral pneumonia, can rapidly progress to hypoxia and death. And unfortunately, in hospitalized infants in particular, it's associated with apnea or cessation of breathing and can cause long-term pulmonary sequela. So it does have a lot of potential long-term consequences, although for most people, it's quote unquote, just a cold. Testing usually begins with a nasal swab in grownups or a wash in infants. There are really outstanding PCR-based or nucleic acid amplification-based tests that can give you a result as quickly as 3 hours. And sometimes those are combined with tests for other respiratory pathogens. Here locally, I know we have one that's RSV, influenza, and COVID. There are also rapid antigen tests, some of which are actually available over the counter. Those take under 30 minutes. They're a little bit less sensitive than the PCR tests, particularly for adults, but perform relatively well in children and can be a helpful diagnostic pathway.
We've already mentioned those two other viruses I was going to bring into the picture. we've seen that seasonal respiratory viruses can cause a perfect storm, as was seen last year with the tridemic or tripledemic that it was called in 2022 with COVID, influenza, and RSV impacting our patients and the healthcare system all at the same time. What's your impression of the likelihood of this occurring again this year, or is it already something that's starting to occur?
So there's the famous quote, it's difficult to make predictions, particularly about the future. That's been attributed to everybody from Niels Bohr, the Nobel Prize winning quantum physicist, to Yogi Berra. So it is very hard to predict. And if anything has made, has very much humbled infectious diseases doctors, it's trying to predict what's happening with respiratory pathogens these days. But if we learned anything from last year, which as you mentioned, was the triple-demic season, winter 2022-2023 was battling simultaneous surges of RSV, influenza, and COVID, particularly in pediatric populations, is that this can happen and it's a real challenge in terms of morbidity and mortality for our patients, but also in terms of extreme stress on our hospital systems. So last year's season was a little bit of an anomaly in that it was impacted by the fact that many of the infants and toddlers had been, didn't have pre-existing immunity to RSV because of the very important non-pharmaceutical interventions of 2020 and 2021 that kept everybody from having COVID all at once. So we won't be facing that same challenge, but in the current context, it's really hard to predict what the RSV season is going to look like and how it will intersect with COVID and with flu. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, just released a statement literally this week that they are worried about a repeat triple epidemic. And current data suggests that, at least in Texas, both flu and RSV are on the rise. I saw my first case of the season of an inpatient adult hospitalized with RSV, lower respiratory tract infection, just a few weeks ago here at University Hospital. So we definitely need to be vigilant. There are other interesting things that we might be able to use in addition to sort of watching the trackers is there was an article published September 15th in Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report on wastewater surveillance data. So they demonstrate quite clearly that wastewater surveillance data, both for flu and for RSV, can predict, is a leading predictor earlier than emergency department visits. So we may also have increased diagnostic or sort of predictive technology to figure out when we really need to worry about these triple epidemics.
So better awareness and better preparation sound like the key messages here. So thanks for that perspective. Okay. Now, before going into the great advances with RSV over this past year, can you touch a little bit on the brief history lesson that we learned about 50 years ago, since it took so long for those initial attempts at RSV vaccine to come to this point in time now where we do have some vaccines? What did we learn from that lesson?
Well, thank you so much for this question, Dr. Rizzo, because I think I love stories of vaccine development and persistence of people who are very much committed to eradicating an illness or preventing an illness. So just like the decades-long persistence of Caitlin Carrico and Drew Weissman and his colleagues, we got lots of press in terms of development of mRNA vaccines for COVID and for other things. The RSV vaccine tale is also a really inspiring one of scientific discovery and persistence. And there's actually a lot of overlap between these two stories. So people have been trying to make an RSV vaccine, particularly for kids, because of the impact of RSV in children for decades. That began in the 60s. It took an early hit when a candidate vaccine in a study actually led to an increased number of RSV lower respiratory tract infections in the kids who got the vaccine. So that is a vaccine developer's nightmare. It's a vaccine. I have run vaccine trials. That's also our nightmare. The last thing we want to do is increase risk for our participants. And that set the field back. There were many other vaccine candidates over the years, but none were particularly successful. And mostly, probably, this is a generalization, but it probably because it turns out that many of those vaccines were targeting the wrong form of the F protein. Now, the F protein is a protein that's on the surface of RSV. It helps the virus enter the cell. It is sort of akin to the spike protein that we talk a lot about in COVID. And when RSV is entering your body or is floating around, it looks like a blob. But it undergoes a conformational change when RSV is fusing to the host cell and it becomes more pointy. So I was trying to think of an analogy for this, and it's kind of like a pufferfish that, you know, if you have a pufferfish and you see it in the water, it just looks like a sort of blobby, regular fish. But if you agitate the pufferfish, it becomes quite spiky. So the problem is that if you're training, like a vaccine wants to train your immune system to recognize RSV, you want to have it recognize the pre-fusion blob-like form that is present before the virus enters the cell, not the fusion form. sort of like if you're looking for a pufferfish and you want to avoid a pufferfish, you need to avoid the version that looks non-spiky in addition to the spiky version. So all of this changed in 2013 when Jason McClellan and Barney Graham and their team published a really groundbreaking science article that showed how they identified this pre-fusion form, the blobby form of F protein in RSV, and then they could lock it in that conformation. So those pre-fusion antibodies were much more potent than the ones that we already had. We already had antibodies to RSV that we could give to people in the form of palivizumab, but the pre-fusion ones were much more effective. And that really jump-started RSV vaccine development, because now there was a much more effective antigen to target for vaccines, and there were new targets also for passive prevention with monoclonal antibodies. So trials started moving forward again very quickly. And then, just as they were about to go into phase three trials for RSV vaccines, the COVID pandemic happened. And Graham and McClellan and their whole team recognized that their work that they were doing could equally apply to vaccine development for SARS-CoV-2. So they pivoted quickly using the exact same technology, including the need for the vaccine to recognize the pre-fusion form of the spike protein, and they made COVID vaccines. We all know how that story ends. The quest was very successful. COVID vaccines were developed in 12 months, largely borrowing from these decades of research that had been done previously to develop other vaccines like RSV. So finally, we've got a vaccine for COVID. It was time for vaccines for RSV, and they were able to transition back to RSV. They ran the trials, and RSV vaccines are here.
Great lesson learned, and a great analogy with the pufferfish. That makes perfect sense. Let's stick with these spike proteins and pufferfish analogies. We know with the COVID vaccine, the spike protein seems to have the ability to evolve and mutate into different variants, which is still occurring. Now, with RSV, we've read about the pre- and post-fusion forms that you just very eloquently explained. Is it going to be something the same we're going to notice about mutations and variants for the RSV formulations, vaccines coming in the future or not?
So this is a really important question. And the good news is that at least to date, RSV mutates less rapidly than SARS-CoV-2 or influenza. However, I can recall that the description of how often SARS-CoV-2 was going to be mutating at the beginning of the pandemic is very different from our understanding now. And any virus under immunologic pressure to mutate will do so. So particularly because all of the things that we're about to talk about, the vaccines and the monoclonal antibody, all target this pre-fusion form, the pre-pufferfish form of the F protein, we're definitely going to have to watch any variations in that protein and in the makeup of that protein, because all of them are targeting those antibodies. There is also an attachment protein called G on RSV that is highly variable. That's usually what we use to determine antigenic structure for RSV, but it's not the target of any of these current modalities that we're going to talk about. And fortunately, we have whole genome sequencing now. It is it's hard, but it is done and it's tracked. And so just like we track variants for COVID, we do track variants already for RSV. You can look at the map and see the mutation sequences. And so we're really going to have to watch for those variants, particularly any escape variants that would render either the vaccines or the monoclonal antibody less effective.
Let's now switch over and talk about some of the new RSV vaccines. The American Lung Association, as part of our mission to promote lung health and prevent lung disease, knows that knowledge and awareness is very empowering for patients. RSV infection in adults may be a new concern for some older adults, especially those with chronic conditions such as asthma and COPD. And we are using our multiple channels to get the information out about the RSV vaccine. Currently, with multiple vaccines, updated COVID shots, yearly influenza, not to mention updating of pneumococcal and diphtheria and tetanus vaccines, one of our concerns is the development of vaccine fatigue, coupled with, as you know, the underlying mistrust in science that's evolved over the last year or two in certain segments of the population. we are concerned that vaccine uptake, especially of this new RSV vaccine, will be less than optimal from a public health standpoint. But all that aside now, let's talk about what we do have in the way of RSV vaccines. And I want to start out talking about the one recommended for older adults with certain comorbidities. Can you tell us how you and your group are going to be handling this vaccine and recommending it?
Yeah. So this is really exciting to have an option for older adults. This is a relatively new recommendation that came down over the summer. The FDA approved 2 in May, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Council Committee on Immunization Praxis, or ACIP, released guidance on June 21st. And the current recommendation is recommending shared decision-making. So what you were talking about, Dr. Rizzo, with the need to have conversations and combat misinformation is really at the forefront of the ACIP's recommendations for this. So they recommend shared decision-making for adults aged 60 or older and vaccination before or at the onset of the RSV season. So they really want you to have a conversation with patients, or for if you're in the community, to have a conversation with your medical provider about the risk and benefits of these new vaccines. This is both because the vaccines are incredibly effective at preventing cases of RSV, particularly the lower respiratory tract infection that we worry so much about in older people. But there were some instances of immune sort of activation in these trials that they want people to know about and make an informed decision about before they get vaccinated. So there are 2 vaccines. One is called Arexvy. It's made by GlaxoSmithKline and Sanofi. And one is called Abrysvo, and that's made by Pfizer. Both of them are protein-based vaccines that target the pre-fusion F protein that we've been talking about so much. Both of them, so the Arexvy vaccine was tested in over 24,000 people across 17 countries. It was effective against both RSV A and B and had really outstanding efficacy of almost 83% against RSV-associated lower respiratory tract disease. It also was very effective against severe respiratory tract disease in the 94% and against overall any acute respiratory tract infection. There was in this trial 1 case of Guillain-Barré syndrome, 1 death due to acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, which may or may have not been related to the vaccine, but occurred in someone who got an RSV vaccine and the flu vaccine simultaneously. And there were some interesting, it is not statistical, but there was a numerical predisposition for atrial fibrillation in the vaccine arm. So the FDA has said that there will be post-marketing surveillance for all 3 of those things in the rollout of this vaccine. The Abrysvo, the Pfizer vaccine, is also pre-fusion F protein vaccine. It doesn't have an adjuvant. That was trialed in over 34,000 adults across 7 countries. I think the efficacy is very similar. Overall efficacy against lower respiratory tract infection was 86%. Overall infection, more protective against severe infections. And similarly, they also saw 1 incident of Guillain-Barré syndrome. They saw an incident of Miller-Fisher and a hypersensitivity reaction. The good news is, so high efficacy, overall, the side effects for both of those vaccines were very mild. 15% of people had fatigue. There was 11% had pain at the injection site, some headaches, some muscle pain. Fever was very rare, which is incredibly helpful in a vaccine. As an infectious disease doctor, there's always the, does my patient have a new illness or do they just have a vaccine reaction? So I think the caveats are that we have these 2 new vaccines, which are highly effective. Neither of these studies that I just mentioned had many participants who were 80 and above, and they also didn't have many participants who were frail or in long-term care facilities. And so I think it's important for us to pay attention to the post-marketing pharmacovigilance to see what happens with those populations. The other caveat, as you noticed in the recommendation from ACIP, the timing of vaccination is supposed to be before the start of the RSV season, and our RSV season has already started. Right. So they are basically saying, offer them as soon as they become available, because I think we're going to need them this fall.
Very good. Like the COVID and flu, we've been given direction that they can be given at the same time. What's the feeling about the RSV vaccine and spacing between other vaccines?
So this is really interesting, and it gets a little bit more complicated, and this gets to some expert recommendation rather than evidence. So the ACIP listed co-administration of new RSV vaccines with other vaccines as acceptable, as long as they are separated on your arm by an inch or given in the opposite arm. However, the only trials to date are really with co-administration with the influenza vaccine. And because of the immunologic safety signal I mentioned, that's one of the reasons that there's all this emphasis on shared decision-making when you're delivered the vaccine. The other thing that happened in some of the co-administration trials was that the antibody titers for both RSV and influenza were a little bit lower in the people who got the vaccines co-administered. So I know some providers who are hesitant to advise RSV co-administration until we have more data. We don't currently have any data on RSV vaccines being given with any of the other vaccines that we might give for this population, like COVID or shingles or pneumonia vaccines. We do have a lot of data that you can give COVID and flu vaccines at the same time very safely. So in my own practice, I'm recommending all of these vaccines. I am now recommending people get flu and COVID shots as soon as possible and also get RSV vaccination. And having that conversation with my patients, some of them might have a really hard time coming back in for a second shot or a third shot. And in that case, they live a long way from the clinic or they have a complicated job. And so I think under those circumstances, I would tell people to go ahead and get them all at once. But shared decision-making is going to be really important, as will be paying attention to those immune signals in the post-marketing data.
Got it. My next question is really came out of a couple editorials I saw about vaccine fatigue and the number of vaccines, and some physicians saying that, an adult who's otherwise, quote, healthy and 65 years old, maybe I'm not going to recommend the RSV vaccine for them. So is age a really important criteria or the comorbidities, or how would you sort that out in this shared decision-making setting?
That is a really great question. So the majority of the people in the trials, as we talked about, were under the age of 70, really. So, and then you have the who is most at risk for getting severe RSV disease. So if you think about the categories of risk, so yes, age is a category, but there are some pretty specific people who you really wouldn't want to get RSV because they're more likely to have these severe lower respiratory tract complications. So people with lung disease is probably pretty obvious, but also cardiovascular disease, diabetes, neurologic disease, kidney disorders, liver disorders, hematology, all of these are listed as risk factors. And then frailty and advanced age or residence in a crowded location, like if you are incarcerated or you're in a long-term care facility, are things that are currently somewhat understudied in the trials that we have, but definitely put people more at risk for severe RSV. My clinical practice is within a clinic that takes care of mostly people living with HIV. So for my patients, I'm going to talk to most of them about getting the RSV vaccine. I already actually have patients emailing me or talking to me about wanting the RSV vaccine. The woman who I took care of in the hospital was in her 50s. And she's like, wait, you mean I can't get an RSV vaccine? I'm sick with RSV. And, her main immunocompromising trait was that she had diabetes. So I think it is really important to talk to people about it. We have a very high prevalence of diabetes and kidney disease in South Texas. And so shared decision-making is important. You have to think about what's their risk. But I think for the majority of my patients, the vaccine would be beneficial.
So I wanted to switch now and talk about the new modalities that are going to affect infants and children and help them prevent having RSV. Why don't we start with the one for the pregnant females?
Great. So my first caveat is I'm not a pediatrician, but I am very excited as a mom and as someone who's, when one of my daughters, when she was under 12 months, had RSV, I can recognize how important this is and how potentially game-changing it really is. If you think about it, RSV is the number one cause of hospitalization for infants in the United States. And if we could reduce that that has the potential to impact health for their lifetime. So the current recommendation, and this is interesting because I was sort of trying to find, are there any other vaccines that are recommended for pregnant people to benefit the infants that will be born, but not necessarily the pregnant people themselves? You know, we vaccinate pregnant people for influenza. That's beneficial for them, but also for the babies, but not in this way. So this is the same Pfizer vaccine, Abrysvo, is now FDA approved as of August 21st. So it's less than a month for pregnant people. The data from this came out of the Matisse study done in 18 countries. Many, many different types of people were involved in this study. And so they vaccinated pregnant people in their third trimester. And they looked at safety for the pregnant people, but efficacy and prevention of RSV-related disease in the babies who were born. So they had 7,300 and something pregnant people, 7,000 and a little bit fewer infants that were the resultant from those pregnancies. And they found that the efficacy and prevention of RSV-related severe lower respiratory tract infections at 3 months was 82%. And at 6 months was still 69%. So that's really, if you think about the burden of RSV illness in the first 6 months of life in particular, that's very impressive. It worked for both RSV A and B, although they had a lot more cases of RSV B in the trial. And there were very, very few adverse events associated with this vaccine. So there was a non-statistical increase in preterm birth and neonatal jaundice and some other maternal events. And so the recommendation now is for the vaccine to be given between 32 and 36 weeks of pregnancy to minimize any potential risk for preterm delivery. But this vaccine has the potential in the sort of ACIP proceedings where they were discussing this, it has the potential to reduce RSV hospitalizations globally by 1 million infants, which is unbelievable.
Very significant. Yes.
Yeah.
Now, in addition to that vaccine, why don't you tell us about the monoclonal antibody and how that fits into the scheme of things?
So the monoclonal antibody, it's like the 1-2 punch to prevent infant and childhood morbidity and mortality from RSV. So this is something called nirsevimab, which is made by Sanofi and AstraZeneca, and it is for prevention of RSV lower respiratory tract disease in neonates and infants that are born during or entering their first RSV season. So basically, that's regulatory terms for all infants born anywhere from sort of early fall all the way into the spring in their first season. And then in the second RSV season, so kids up to 24 months of age could get actually a second dose of this monoclonal antibody if they are at high risk for RSV disease. And that includes not just kids who are immunocompromised or have pre-existing lung conditions, but also other risk group, including American Indian and Alaska Native populations who have a 4 to 10 times higher hospitalization rate for RSV than any other group in the United States. So this was approved by the FDA, and the ACIP recommended use of this monoclonal antibody on August 3rd. I've had the opportunity to talk to some of my friends who are pediatricians, and they want to use this basically as soon as they can get it. They've already started seeing some babies born to people who received the RSV vaccine, but they're very excited about the monoclonal antibody. And I think overall, relative risk reduction is 70 to 75% for lower respiratory tract infection from RSV.
So prior to these advances, which you very nicely and summarized, great detail, we had the treatment with ribavirin as an option for severely ill infants, but there was efficacy questions and the cost made this not something was used too often. There also was the antibody, monoclonal antibody you mentioned, pembrolizumab, for available for prophylaxis. How do you think these new advances are going to change the role of these particular drugs?
So it's been interesting talking to and listening to pediatric ID folks talk about the role that palivizumab is going to have once nirsevimab comes online. So just for people who are not familiar with palivizumab, it is another monoclonal antibody. It recognizes the RSV fusion form of the F protein, so the spiky version. And it reduces the incidence of severe disease in very high-risk infants. And so there's a very limited scope for use of that, as opposed to the nirsevimab, which is for, you know, all infants born during an RSV season. It is one shot monthly for every month for 5 months. And as you mentioned, it's very expensive. And so, like I said, I'm not a pediatrician, but it really seems as if nirsevimab will largely replace palivizumab once people can get it. For treatment, you mentioned ribavirin, and really the only context in which it is indicated is its consideration for use for RSV in immunocompromised people. So as an adult ID doc, we see this sometimes in people who are profoundly immunocompromised or are transplant patients or things like that. None of the things that we have talked about really are for treatment of RSV. You'll note everything's for prevention. And as a public health person, I'm all for prevention. But my guess is that ribavirin will still be used. But as you mentioned, there's really very limited data for use in pediatric populations of ribavirin for treatment. So I think hopefully we've got some things coming down the pipeline.
Very good. Well, you've covered RSV very nicely for us. But before I let you go, I wanted to take advantage of your infectious disease expertise with two non-RSV questions. One, again, is asking you to be like Yogi Berra. Do you think we've reached a point where the yearly COVID vaccines are going to be recommended? Or are we still going to be seeing multiple vaccinations throughout years?
So this is a really good question. I'm going to do what I said I wasn't going to do and make a prediction. I think we're there. I think, you know, we just saw their ACIP September 12th recommendations for they're being called boosters, but really they are additional vaccines for the new variant for COVID. And data presented just this week from the CDC that look at there's sort of a systematic analysis of data on the waning of immunity after vaccines and boosters really suggests that we're going to need regular immunity boosters for COVID. That combined with the fact that SARS-CoV-2 just keeps mutating and there will likely be new variants and some of them will likely escape in a world where COVID is endemic and there's so much pressure for COVID to mutate. I think we're going to need these for a few years. But had you asked me if Zika was going to be a consistent problem a couple of years ago, I might have told you yes, too. So take everything, I think, with large grains of salt. But for the time being, I think we should be prepared for COVID vaccines pretty regularly.
And my other question has to do with influenza. Universal influenza vaccine has been in the works for a while, but there's recently a clinical trial started by NIH. I know there's other researchers who are working down the road from you at Texas Biomedical Institute in San Antonio, looking into universal flu vaccines. What are some of the advantages of ultimately getting that vaccine approved and done?
I will say it's really exciting to work down the street from Texas Biomed because it does really feel like we're on the cutting edge of a lot of new technology. For flu vaccination, our current situation is we get a new flu vaccination formula every year. And that is based on a very educated guess about what strains are going to be circulating. And so that means that every year we have slightly different vaccine efficacy against whatever is circulating in the real world. And sometimes there are surprises. So it would be amazing to be able to have a universal flu vaccine that covered the water of potential flu strains and gave us protection. However, flu is very good at rearranging itself. So we'll definitely need the same continued vigilance that we talked about for COVID and for RSV. Right. And unfortunately, a universal vaccine doesn't mean we won't have seasonal flu and that it can't escape like it did in 1918. But amazing to have a vaccine that was reliable over years.
Very good. So before we close, I'll give you one more chance to predict the future. let me know if you think, what do you think are some of the advances in respiratory pathogen prevention or therapy that you really hope we have in our lifetime to see?
So I put these things in sort of two categories, and I am going to attempt to predict the future. So again, all the caveats. I think probably the most important thing we need is to make sure that when we have new vaccines or preventative modalities, like the amazing wealth that we have right now, is to make sure that they can get to people who need them most. And that is an advance in and of itself. So folks who are living in crowded settings, folks who are incarcerated, long-term care facilities, think about this specific indication for the monoclonal antibody, nirsevimab for American Indian or Alaskan Native populations. Are we doing the appropriate outreach and confronting all of the misinformation that you mentioned to make sure that communities who most need these modalities have access? Are we working on structural barriers like cost and delivery? And that's important, not just in the United States, but globally. If we want to save 1 million hospitalizations from RSV, then we have to get the shots out to 1 million potential people who need them. And so COVID demonstrated how quickly a respiratory virus can sweep across our globe, and also how important it is that we pay attention not just to what's happening in the United States, but what's happening globally and how important equity is. So that's one sort of bucket of things.
Absolutely.
The other bucket is the amazing new technology bucket, and there's much more to come, I think, in terms of scientific advances. There are going to be more monoclonal antibodies, both for treatment and prevention. That's really exciting because I'm all for prevention. Like I mentioned, I am very pro public health, but we definitely need more options for RSV treatment. It would have been amazing for me to be able to treat my patient in the hospital a couple of weeks ago with something that would have reduced her duration of infection or her symptoms. And there are many more vaccines in the pathway for RSV. I would expect that we'll see some expansion of indications. Like right now, we have 60 and over and pregnant people. My guess is that there will be more to come in all of these modalities.
Great. Well, I want to thank you again for joining us today with your wealth of information on viruses in general and respiratory pathogens. So for others who have followed us on Lungcast the last 3 years, you know we have an impressive library of interviews regarding respiratory viruses. Among the others, there were recent episodes with Dr. Julia Moore Vogel on long COVID and a flu conversation with Dr. Shantanu Agarwal. So be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.